anyway.
No, he and I were friends. George Wright was here at the time. We were friends. Not intimate friends. Bill Newman and Tischler were much closer friends. But I knew all sorts of other people here, such as Gershinowitz, who was working with Tistiakovsky, and I think, though this may be one of those things I better check to see that it's not a a memory trick, that how was his first name? O-G-G?
Yeah, I know the spelling. I don't know his first name.
We'll
can check it out.
Was, I think he was here at the time. Whenever it was that I knew Og, it was quite fascinating because he had all sorts of wild and usually erroneous ideas, but bubbled with ideas, and it was great fun. There were quite a number of splendid people here at the time, who were interesting and important. One of my lab mates was Merritt Quattleman. Spelled just the way it's pronounced.
Quattlebaum.
I don't know what kind of a tree a quattle tree is, but his name was Quattlebaum. I came here from Dartmouth, you know, I was a young kid and very green, but sorry, there's a pun there, but it was unintended. I was introduced to Merritt Quattlebaum right away. First person I was introduced to here. And innocent as I wasn't innocent enough to believe that. I knew they were pulling my leg. It turned out his name was Merritt Quattlebaum. And he was doing porphyrin syntheses with Cohen's. And was on the next bench to mine. And helped me a great deal scientifically. He later set himself up in business in North Carolina, and I've seen him recently. He's been a great financial success and has a big, thriving personal business.
Is it a chemical business?
Chemical business, oh yes.
Oh, yes.
And Bill McEwen was in the lab. This is a different Bill McEwen than the one who is now at the University of Massachusetts, who is a much younger man. I have no idea what's happened to that Bill McEwen.
This is the one who did the acidity studies.
Acidity studies. Now, Bill McEwen and I were acquainted. We were not friends. But having those acidity studies going on in the same lab as the one I was in, and having the porphyrin synthesis going on in the same lab I was in, were both very, very helpful. And I got more stimulation, much more stimulation scientifically, from Conant's lab than I did from Cole. On the other hand, my friendships and scientific discussions with Tischler and Newman were much better than the ones I had had.
There was a graduate student of Pease's at the time who later went into medicine and then died of cancer, who made methylcholanthine in Pease's lab at the time, which was the most powerful carcinogen made in Pease's lab and one of the most powerful carcinogens known at the time, and I think still among the best, though I don't think it can compete with aflatoxin. But
That was an interesting piece of work to have underway at that time. Mm-hmm. And the synthesis was interesting. Experimentally. I'll have to remember this. Seligman is his name. He probably also had a first name, but I don't know the way. One of the steps was a Grignard. Seligman had an aromatic bromide. Tried to make the Grignard, failed. Couldn't be made. Took the recovered bromide from the Grignard, recrystallized, put it back in the Grignard work. Which is a nice statement that there was some minor impurity there, mm-hmm, that probably was mopped up in the first attempt to make the Grignard. Mm-hmm. And then it went on. Well, I don't know if that's so great and important, but it was a little vignette of experimental part of chemistry. That
and it meant something to you.
It meant something to me at the time. There was another story at the time which was important to me, but I would like you to turn the tape off.
Okay.
All right. You asked me where my interest in biochemistry came from. And it comes in, I think, large part from the fact that there was biochemistry going on in Konitz's laboratory, and I watched Quattlebaum do his porphyrin syntheses, and I'll say more about that later because I did porphyrin syntheses myself. Mm-hmm. A very important influence on us. But the discovery of vitamin K occurred, Doisy's discovery of vitamin K, structure and synthesis, came out in the Journal of the American Chemical Society during my years as a graduate student and made a great impression. The first, I have to tell a lot about Konitz.
Yes, I do.
But when Konitz finally accepted me as a graduate student, I asked him for a good textbook in organic chemistry. He said, well, you know, there isn't really a very good textbook. I said, do you read German? I said, well, I can read German, but not very well. He said, well, the best textbook is Karrer's Lehrbuch. And if you don't read German very well, by all means, buy it. So I bought Karrer's Lehrbuch. This had already been translated. Mm-hmm. And used that. And I also bought the first edition, I wonder if it's on my shelf, of Hickel's Theoretische Grundlage. Which I read avidly, didn't like very much, this is the first volume of the seventh edition, and my shelf is missing. I think I had that when I was here at Harvard and labored over Hickel's involved German with great pain.
You you did footnote in one article. I think it was it may have been the compensation article, the retro Aldol.
Yes.
And I noticed that. I was going to ask you about it, so I'm glad that you brought it up.
It was the only textbook of physical organic chemistry in the world at the time, I think. And it didn't look upon physical organic chemistry at all the way I did. Mm-hmm. But it was the only one there was, and I read it, and I worked on it, and sweated over it. Mm-hmm. My German was not terribly good then, it was determined to get back home. Karrer is easy. Karrer is lovely, straightforward, simple sentences.
Yes.
I could read without any trouble. I want to tell a story about Coleman that's let me tell something first. At the end of my first year, I was going to go home for the summer and not spend the summer here at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And wanted to do chemistry. And Coleman suggested that I spend the summer in Alsop Corwin's laboratory at Johns Hopkins. Corwin had been one of Koenig's students engaged in porphyrin synthesis and maintained a laboratory at Hopkins, in which he did such work to the end of his career. And I worked in Corwin's laboratory on syntheses of pyrroles, dipyrrolmethanes, and dipyrrolmethenes. I don't think I ever got up any porphyrin. And did a great deal of preparative synthetic chemistry, much of it on quite a large scale. I needed that laboratory experience very badly. It was good for me. Even though I'd been doing research, it was good for me to do all these preps. They were extremely interesting mechanistically because they involved the nor parole synthesis. Do you know this synthesis?
No, I don't think I do.
Standard parole, so called. Takes ethylacetylase, acetic acid, sodium nitrite, glycosylate the ethylacetylase, and of course isomerizes the oxygen. Mm-hmm. Adds another molar equivalent of ethylacetylase, zinc and acetic acid.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's done in acetic acid, it's soluble. That reduces the oxime, the amino group.
Mm-hmm.
That condenses. This, of course, is an activated methylene condenses.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you have the
summarized. Right. The growth. Well, that synthesis can be modified hundreds of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the standard synthesis that was adopted and adapted by Hans Fischer. Mm-hmm. In his widespread syntheses that led
to his synthesis of helium. And, you know, it has nice mechanistic implications, as well as being good heterocyclic chemistry. And I learned a lot by doing that work in that lab. But I must also say that Alsop Corwin was one of the important influences on my life, because he's an eccentric, but he was always reading and talking about interesting things. I went back to Corwin's laboratory again the summer after I got my PhD, where he let me work in his laboratory. I was working on my own things then.
I see.
But I had lots and lots and lots of conversation with Corwin. And Corwin read very widely and brought up many topics where I think he often didn't have the right ideas, but he stimulated a lot of discussions that for which I'm enormously grateful. The story about Conant that I want to tell, and this will get me almost into the things that I've listed, but which is a very important part of my scientific career, is the following. When I was a graduate student at Harvard, even though I did synthetic work with Kohler, and even though I had done a lot of pyrrole and dipyromethane lithene synthesis with Corwin, I was primarily interested in theoretical organic chemistry. I intended to be a theoretical organic chemist and work on reaction mechanism. And I can talk a little bit about where the mechanistic ideas came from in those days. When I got my PhD, I felt then more confident of my command of chemistry than I have at any time since. I knew a whole set of problems and reaction mechanisms. I knew how to tackle them, what to do to get evidence that some hypothesis was correct or incorrect. And I could look around the literature at the vast wasteland and see that, except for Ingold's laboratory, which was doing quite different things. I mean, he was doing displacement reactions, and I want to do condensation reactions. There wasn't anybody doing anything. And especially in the United States, the people who were considered the great organic chemists were not doing anything that I considered of much interest, and certainly nothing that was competitive with anything that I wanted to do. So I felt the field of this whole vast field, it was mine. There wasn't anyone else out there. Now, of course, it's easy to see in retrospect how silly it was. What I had not realized was that there were then half a dozen, and soon to be dozens, of other people who knew exactly the same thing. They hadn't appeared yet. Winstein had not surfaced. Barton was just beginning. Roberts hadn't begun. The
large number of physical organic chemists that were going to build this whole new subject weren't there. I could look at atoms and marble and know that
they're going to be in competition, right?
The bastard at the Columbia.
Oh, the chairman.
Name gives it a B. I'll think of his name too. He wasn't going to be a competitor, and
I looked around and Hammett was doing extremely interesting things, but they weren't the kind of things that I wanted to do. And
he wasn't even an organic chemist.
He wasn't even an organic chemist. And quite good. The whole world was mine. And I had won a National Research Council fellowship. There weren't many of them, and I'd won one, and I'd won it on this project that I'd submitted of my own, in contrast to many of the projects submitted today, you know, there's somebody else's, on the kinetics and mechanism of the benzoic acid variant, which I thought was a fine problem, although it had been my intention eventually, as I did just a little, to return to condensation reactors. But I didn't want to do it then because I'd worked on semi-carbazone formation with Kolin. And I wanted to break away and not be associated with what I had done with Kolin. But I thought it was a perfectly good problem. Well, after I got my PhD, Kolin called me to the president's office. He hadn't seen me since he had deserted the ship in 1933. He sat me down. And,
by the way, there was that feeling that he had deserted chemistry.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I heard that before.
He sat me down and he said, I got my PhD. I began work with him. I got my PhD with Kohler. He was interested in what I was doing. And I said, well, I want an actual Research Council fellowship. I said, well, what are you going to do? So I outlined the great problem, this problem. And Kohler sat there, silent for a moment or two, thinking. And he said, well, if you are successful, that will be a footnote to a footnote in the history of chemistry. And in contrast to my statement about the dean of freshmen at Dartmouth, that remark struck home.
Did it then, or was it
right
later?
Then, if there was ever an occasion when someone who had been looking down looked up, it was in response to that remark. I think I had not really been sufficiently ambitious. I had been about the things that I thought were fun and interesting. But it had never occurred to me until that moment, really, that I would be able to have a real part in the history of chemistry. And the notion that Coleman essentially was saying, well, that problem is all right, but good God, you can do better, was very important to him. And from then on, I tried to ask myself about problems, whether they were really worth the investment of time. And then, I guess in a very conceited thing to say, but I will say it anyway, it seems to me that many of the scientists I know who are much brighter than I fail to ask themselves that question and wasted talents that I could only envy on problems that weren't worth it.
That's, well, that's an important statement with respect to how science develops, I think, and we can discuss that.
But that's one of the things that I had on my list that I wanted to say.
Yeah, no, that's a terribly important statement. Let's see. We still have a little bit on this tape. You were a John Harvard Fellow.
Yes.
What was that? How were you appointed? What did it mean?
It was an honor. And what it meant was that my parents could afford to put me through the university.
So it carried no stipend?
It carried no stipend. In earlier days, I think the John Harvard Fellowships had carried whatever stipend the individual needed, but by the middle of the Depression, it carried no stipend. My parents could afford to support me and were willing to support me. And the John Harvard Fellowship carried no stipend. I'm very much in favor of that sort of thing. It would have seemed to me grossly unfair if my record at Harvard had shown no honors. Because I wasn't poor enough to be entitled to them. Today, everyone who goes to graduate school essentially is supported on merit and regardless of finances. But in those days, if you could afford, if you could find the money, of course your parents wouldn't support you, they wouldn't, but if you could find the money, you weren't allowed any of the financial scholarships. And I'm very pleased that Harvard gave me that one, which carried no stipend. Incidentally, I wanted to have the experience of teaching and was barred from applying for a teaching fellowship because I didn't need the money. So I applied to Beezer for permission to teach in Chem 20, it was then Chem 2, for free. And he turned me down.
Okay, let's see. that goes along with some other things. Before we get on to your real scientific career, I wanted to ask about the courses that you took, the courses that were offered here, and the faculty members that were around at the time. Do you remember the courses that you took?
Well, I remember very well the course in physical chemistry that I took from Christian Constant, which was quite a good course, although the quantum theory that was taught was Bohr theory. And although the Schrodinger equation had been published, George did not teach it. So the quantum chemistry was somewhat inadequate. On the other hand, I learned the thermodynamics quite thoroughly, and at the time of that final examination, could sit down on my own and produce, I think, almost all the equations in North America. I can't do it today, but I really learned that material inside and out. The organic chemistry course was Kohler's Chem 5, and was marvelous for me. It was the intermediate level organic chemistry course. I and my friends had not taught each other at Dartmouth, and that I really needed desperately. For reasons not clear to me, I was not registered for the course. I audited it. I guess Kohler told me that since I had had an intermediate level organic chemistry course, I could audit it. But I knew better, and got Kohler's permission to take the our exams and other exams along with the rest of the people in the course, which I did, auditing or no auditing, because otherwise I would never have known if I was doing it or not. Fieser was giving the course, and